Thank you, Tony. My name is David Livingston. I'm the author of 7 books. I've been at this for 35 years, researching independently. I self-publish my books because I have no hope in having this published by any regular publishers. I also like the independence. I operate a website called ordoabco.ca, which features most of my books. My recent ones are a 6-volume set of Ordo Abco, Zionism, History of a Jewish Heresy, and my most recent book is a 2-volume set of Divide and Conquer, Muslims versus Islam.
Well, look, Ordo Abco is probably the most mysterious of your titles, in that it's Latin, it means order from chaos, and I think many of us are becoming increasingly aware of this concept, which I suppose was popularly introduced by Naomi Klein, the shock doctrine, this idea of disaster capitalism, which we're seeing right now, actually, in Gaza, with various vampires, hawks, vultures, really, hovering around, looking at Gaza. Wow, here's loads of real estate. We can move in, we can rebuild it. So can you just give us an idea if that concept has got really anything to do with the title of the book?
I hadn't tied it to be honest, I hadn't tied it to that specifically, but it's approximately what it is. The idea of course, it's the slogan or motto of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, and I guess taken at face value, it's the idea that they are working towards creating order out of chaos, so that society, of course, is currently supposedly chaotic, and they want to bring order to it. But I've relied heavily on a book. It's actually a French book about Jacob Frank by a French author named, I think his first name is Charles Novak. It's an excellent book, fascinating. In fact, it's a pretty decent book from a scholarly perspective about Jacob Frank, but he also dares to cover angles that I've seen other academics avoid. And so what he shows is how the doctrines of Frankism interpret we've talked about this many times before, that they're trying to bring about the end times. And that and this is where we could come back to people like Peter Thiel and Nick Land, is the idea of accelerating the coming of the end times. And to do that, because the prophecies predict that chaos is to precede the end times and the return or the coming of the Messiah, that they therefore have to create those chaotic conditions. So this is also a satanic perspective. So they believe that, they have to. That, in fact, this is kind of what I'm interpreting, especially from somebody like Peter Thiel, is an attempt to try to understand evil as being necessary. So not necessarily being a rejection of God or a combating God, but rather that if everything is to be interpreted as the unfolding of a history towards the redemption, or however you want to refer to it, that evil is a part of that entire formula. So they don't see it as necessarily something bad, but an aspect which is necessary towards this fulfillment. So I think that's kind of how, maybe it's from Nick Land that I'm always getting this perspective. So he effectively justifying their participation or contribution to what would otherwise be considered evil, because it helps bring about, the ends justify the means, and it helps bring about the ultimate good, which is fulfillment to prophecy. So to come back to your point, which it basically means the need to foment chaos, to create the conditions of chaos that are necessary for the coming of the Messiah. So things like war, disease, famine, destruction, murder, and so on and so forth. Every possible aspect of societal decay, which would be, in their minds, accelerating the coming. I'd be curious to, I'm still trying to understand what's happening in Israel, because it seems like my initial interpretation is that, you know, this is Israel was only created in 1948. The Zionist movement was only created in the late 1800s. First Zionist Congress was at 1796 or 97. So it's understood to be a fairly recent movement, but really in reality, the sources of Zionism are quite old, right? So what I try to trace in my Zionism book is that they go back at least probably to the Crusades, more recently at least to movements like the movement Shabtai Zvi, Jacob Frank, and the Haskalah of Moses Mendelssohn. So what was my point?
You're talking about the Crusades. I have to ask you, because obviously Zionism is very similar to the Crusades. Mm-hmm. It's the idea of Europeans launching a kind of fortress territory right in and around Jerusalem. I mean, we had Baldwin and other kings. European kings were installed there until they were booted out by local Muslims. So, you know, that doesn't sound so far-fetched that it should go back. So can you even just maybe talk about some of those connections between, and maybe through the Templars, you know, the Vatican-inspired army of maniacs that had a dual role, it seemed. One was to take over the Holy Land, but the other one most definitely seems to be to destroy Constantinople and the Orthodox Church. But so is there some sort of connection between that attempt to install this fortress state back hundreds of years ago in medieval times and what's happening in Israel right now?
Yes, I believe so. So there's a number of ways of looking at it. So this, you know, one of the main themes of my book on Zionism is this myth of the Night Swan. And why it's all curious is because for, I believe, the Second Zionist Congress, Herzl opened it with Wagner's overture from the which opera would it be? The Tannhauser opera, which is related to the theory of the Night Swan. This is why, you know, he was connected with Ludwig II, right? Of Bavaria, who famously built Neuschwanstein, the new Swan Castle, because this whole Swan theme was, you know, crucial to these families. And this is why he also comes back to Moses Mendelssohn, because he was part of a network of German philosophers that are part of what's called Weimar classicism, which was centered at Weimar, which was ruled by the family of Saxe-Weimar-Eisenach, who also traced their descent from the Night Swan. And it was led by Goethe's friend, who was Karl August of Saxe-Weimar-Eisenach. So according to Houston Stuart Chamberlain, who was Wagner's son-in-law, Wagner was actually the illegitimate child. His mother was a illegitimate child of Karl August's brother. So why this is interesting is because the whole myth of the Night Swan was originally devised to provide a, to get to the point, to propose a demonic ancestry to Godfrey of Bouillon. So the idea is basically there's this mysterious character who floats up in a boat pulled by swans and mysteriously appears on the European scene and becomes the father of Godfrey and his two brothers. And so this was widely accepted, I guess, I don't know what kind of circles, but aristocratic circles, as being an explanation of the sources of Godfrey's ancestry. And so this was maintained through the years and had all kinds of various important significances, like tied to Cygnus, right, which is the astrological sign of the swan, which was important to the Rosicrucians, and it was timed with the date of the appearance of the, I think it was somehow connected with the Great Conjunction, which they connected to their announcement to the world in 1623, and so on and so forth. Just to say, you know, this is a running theme for 1,000 years, and it goes back to the Crusades. So what's interesting is that who is considered to be the first to have articulated something along the lines of a Zionist expectation? Because, you know, in traditionally in Orthodox Judaism, I don't want to say Orthodox, people can confuse that with Hasidism, but let's say traditional Judaism. There's such what's called three oaths. And one of the three oaths prescribes that Jews are not allowed to colonize the land of Palestine, that you have to wait. This is an event which will happen when God deems it to be due. And so, as you described it, Tony, you are not to force God's hand. But one of the first to begin articulating a sort of national desire for a homeland was Rashi. That's an acronym. I can't remember what his real full name was, but he's considered probably the most important, influential Jewish scholar of recent times, at least in the European scene. So he was based in the city of Troyes in France, which was part of the region of Champagne. And so that region of Champagne was ruled by Hugh of Champagne, who was one of the nine founders of the Knights Templar, and he had some kind of a relationship with Rashi. Rashi was also, in contact or in communication with Stephen Harding, who was a friend of Bernard of Clairvaux, who was the patron saint of the Templars. Because I think that this is the only way that I find that the whole concept of the Crusades is inexplicable. That that basically the entire Middle East was ruled by Muslims all the way into Spain, across North Africa, the Levant, and not yet the area of Turkey. But so why did they choose to attack? They could have attacked them in Spain. They could have, joined supported the Reconquista or something like that. But no, they decided to basically cut through that entire area and focus specifically on Jerusalem. And I believe it's because they knew that there were, quote unquote, treasures that were buried beneath the temple. And so the purpose of the Crusades was to seize control of Jerusalem for at least long enough to allow them to conduct the excavations beneath the temple, which they did. And I believe it's how they were discovered the Sefer HaBahir, which is the book that set off the revival of the Kabbalah. And so I think that the Templars were effectively a front, and the fact that the Templars adhered to a belief system which was not very Christian, but a belief system which is almost identical with the Cathars. And the Cathars themselves, if you look at, I can't remember what his name is, but this is a Jewish scholar who wrote a book called Jewish Sects and Movements or something like that. It's a book that basically traces Jewish influence in Christian society from effectively the time of the Crusades to at least Martin Luther. And he points out the extensive relationship between, the clear influence of Jewish influence on those Christian movements like the Cathars. So it's effectively, it's a Jewish Gnostic influence that infiltrated Christianity, that part of the world, and produced the Cathar movement, which was basically one and the same with the Templars. When you look at the Templar missions, it's some very interesting things that they worship. Of course, it's very famously, they apparently spat on the cross. They repudiated Jesus. Supposedly, they revered John the Baptist instead, which links them to the Mandaeans of the Middle East. And they also practiced what was called the obscene kiss. And the obscene kiss is the same thing. It was the same ritual that was practiced not only by the Cathars, but also by the witches, which was that they would have to, so the devil would be represented in the form of a black cat, and they would have to pucker up and kiss it on the anus.
Well, yes, if you go to Margaret Murray and her books on witchcraft, two main ones, which is The Witch Cult in Western Europe and also The God of the Witches, what she will say is that rather than a cat, you've got a person called the devil, who was the high priest of the coven,
right.
And that was the one that you went and did this so-called holy
obscene kiss
to.
Yeah.
But anyway, so a lot of this stuff is starting to, you know, reach, or not quite to the mainstream, David.
No, yeah.
But particularly the talk about the occult, particularly in relation to AI, and I think it's actually quite refreshing to see that former Fox News presenter Tucker Carlson, who has been actually quite good over the years. I mean, for example, exposing corruption of the companies producing these voting machines. He's quite good, many would say, during COVID, at being balanced about, you know, whether this is something that's being pushed, very much pushed by the pharmaceutical industry and the military. Very critical of Tony Fauci, etc. But he was very friendly with this guy, Charlie Kirk, who was a big recruiter for the Republican Party and for Christianity in the United States, and who was assassinated last month. So there's been quite a lot of ramifications of that. But he was friendly. And it's almost, I think it was a big shock to Tucker Carlson that somebody like that could just be blown away. And in a way, of course, it's a threat to anybody espousing those sorts of spiritual views, so which Tucker is fairly close to. So he, it seems, has kind of gone up, almost like gone up a level in terms of the people he's interviewing. With this guy, Conrad Flynn, he was talking to you last week, he spent almost an hour and a half talking about the occult, and particularly some of the subjects which you have gone into in great depth, in Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, and the whole idea of a kind of technocracy movement that's been going for a very long time, which sees technology as kind of making humans obsolete in a way, like human 2.0, the sort of ideas picked up by Noah Harari, Dark Enlightenment of my old school friend Nick Land, who's now over in Shanghai scribbling away. But anyway, what do you make of that interview and some of the issues that came out? Because, I mean, obviously, he didn't particularly talk about accelerationism or the Dark Enlightenment specifically, but he was talking around all these subjects. So I wonder if you think it was a useful thing to have got to a massive audience. I think within about 2 days, there's over 2 million people have watched it.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I'm really curious to see where it's going to go. We talked about this. This is the first open discussion of these topics at that level of popularity, right? That level in the mainstream that I've seen personally. Because I think Tucker Carlson is an interesting character because, of course, he comes from his dad was basically CIA. Tucker applied for the CIA, but supposedly turned down the offer or was refused or something like that. He started the Daily Caller with a guy named Neil Patel, who was a member of the CNP, the Council for National Policy, which is basically, you know, it's the main arm that connects the American right to the Fascist International. It's an organization that includes people like Robert Mercer, Steve Bannon, the Koch brothers, and it really connects, you know, that whole sort of Christian far right in the United States. It's connected. I think Daily Caller was, of course, connected by organizations like the Heritage Foundation, which is also basically sort of pretty much a Zionist front. They've received funding from the Koch brothers, the Bradley Foundations. There's three main foundations that have been funding the American right for the last, I don't know how many, 50 years or so. And that's the Bradley Foundation, the Olin Foundation, and the Scaife Foundation, which is from the Mellon family, which is particularly interesting. So Carlson comes right out of the deep state, right? And so it's interesting to see where he's going now. Everybody's, you know, there's a tendency to label people and to, you know, if people are, I think it's always important to remember that everyone's an individual and everyone has free will and thinks for themselves. So just because they come from a certain background or belong to certain organizations doesn't mean that they have to necessarily, that everything they do is according to the plan, right? So I don't know what's going on, if this is part of the plan or if Tucker's kind of breaking free somehow. But it's a pretty important shift Because he's made two important shifts, right? The important shift is that he's really been leading the Republican shift away from support of Israel. And then now, I guess maybe it's probably tied together because he seems to be, I think he's long identified as a Christian, but he seems to be, or I think he's more openly or deeply so identifying with a basic Christian outlook, which is where this is coming from. He's often referencing this idea about, you know, the existence of spiritual entities, demonic entities, and to what extent, you know, to understand what's happening, you have to acknowledge paranormal influences effectively. And this seems to be where this conversation came from. So I think from that angle, it's very important because I agree that that's the only way to begin to fully understand. Like, you know, that's the problem is that, you know, effectively the only critique of the right is a left-wing critique, but it's an atheistic, you know, critique that doesn't accommodate expanding, you know, our understanding of world leaders and their ideologies. The only way to do that is really to dabble in the very weird, as we have, right? To look at their occult beliefs and, you know, where these things came from, and it comes from a whole lot of strange sources. So, yeah,
well, these two, yeah. as they're talking, they yeah. got to get into this whole idea of hallucinogenic drugs, which, right. again, you know, name check Nick for being into that age 16,
right.
particularly.
Right.
And, then they start saying, well, on these drugs, you can see all sorts of things. You don't really know if a yeah. demonic entity you see on drugs is real or not. And then yeah. Carlson sort of jokes and chips in and says, well, what if two people are seeing the same thing at the same time?
Yeah.
You know, so he's suggesting here that this is a sort of doorway, a gateway into yeah. a spirit world, which is mostly hidden. The other mm-hmm. thing is, of course, if you go into witchcraft, which is always use drugs, at least according mm-hmm. to Dennis Wheatley, there's a big use of drugs of all sorts, particularly things like magic mushrooms and things like that by the witches and into witchcraft. So this is yeah. it's starting to sort of almost go through the Overton window and out the other side, you know.
Yeah.
So but do you think what do you think of what they were discussing is really valuable, because a lot of it yeah. was discussing AI, wasn't it, and this is also being yeah. talked about right now
yeah.
by some of the leading people, JP Morgan, etc. Hang on, guys, this could be just a yeah. little bubble that could
yeah.
So what do you think the purpose of AI is, and how does it link to this?
Yeah, so this, you know, this is what makes it all interesting. I'm still trying to understand how they all link together. But the four aspects that all connect would be drugs, as you say, AI, and aliens, right? So I don't know. And, of course, the Antichrist, singularity, all that stuff. But it all works together. That's what's interesting is that this is what I show in my book on transhumanism, is that transhumanism specifically, that both all came out of MK Ultra, that their MK Ultra had two channels, and one of them was experimentation with drugs and the other one was development of the personal computer. And that's why they sort of reunite in the transhumanist movement, where this is why Leary became really an exponent of both, right? And I as I pointed out, the movie Lucy, I don't know if you remember that one with Scarlett Johansson, I say basically portrays exactly what these people believe. In short, the idea is that to support your point, so MK Ultra was deliberately an attempt to revive what was understood as ancient shamanism. Right? So that Aldous Huxley's plan, right? His whole idea of a Brunel philosophy. This is why in Brave New World, the name of the drug used to control the population is called Soma. And the reason he picked that name is because Soma there's two famous, well, there's like three famous drugs that were used by mystics in ancient times. There was a Haoma, which was used by the Zoroastrians. There's the Kaikion, I think is what it's called, in the Licinian Mysteries. And then there's a Soma, which was mentioned in the Vedas. So because the way that these occultists understand it is that these ancient shamans were able to ingest a drug that allow them to tap into the spiritual world and make contact with disembodied spirits. So this is consciously what they were trying to replicate through experiments in the CIA, combined with things like, you know, torture and trauma and things like that. This is why they did quite a, this is the, you know, this is not like speculation. There's declassified documents that show, that reveal that the CIA was conducting things like electroshock and things like that on children to try, and drugs to try to achieve schizophrenia, because schizophrenia is understood to be a type of demonic possession. So this is why, out of the same track, all of going back to the Macy Foundation and the cybernetics movement, there are twin paths that were developed by the CIA, and there are always a parallel that you find that the people who are leading the development of the personal computer also happened, typically were, had connections with MKUltra. And so to come back to the movie Lucy, the point was that she takes a drug that makes her so intelligent that eventually she's able to merge with some kind of AI, and that's effectively what they think they are going to do. They think that the brain is just a biological organic computer that can be reverse engineered, so even that your personality can be, it's a, it could be replicated or migrated over to a software program that could basically live forever in a computer program. And somewhere along the way, there's the whole idea of aliens fits into this, because aliens effectively, this is where the ancient aliens program comes in, which is actually Luciferian program. What the ancient aliens believe is the same old Kabbalistic idea, the same idea that fed into the construction of the myth of the Aryan race, which is that on Atlantis, that Atlantis refers to the period described in the Bible taking place before the flood, where the sons of God, or the Anakim, came in, the Nephilim, sorry, had bred with the daughters of Cain and produced a superior race called the Anakim, who survived the flood and basically became the ancestors of the, well, either which way, it means in the Bible, it's the ancestors of the Canaanites, but understood in modern occultism, it means the Aryan race. So effectively, this whole ancient aliens ridiculous series on television is trying to propose that the ancient, what were characterized as aliens now were actually the sons of God who taught superior advanced technology to the early humans, which resulted in, you know, construction of various constructions like the pyramids in either South America or in Egypt and so on and so forth, advanced technology as they like to call it. And the show actually openly admits that these fallen angels were led by Lucifer. So I don't know how it fits together, but somehow all these various trajectories are meant to feed into some kind of antichrist scenario. My only inkling is that I think that the AI is, because of course the whole purpose of AI is to produce even what H.G. Wells called as the global, I don't know if he called it global mind or global brain. It's two terms that have been sort of tossed around, but that's a lot of the idea. I think these guys talked about it. I think Tucker Carlson talked about it. The idea of creating a global brain. So that's what AI is supposed to do. It's supposed to create a computer, an AI that will have access to the totality of human information, totality of human activity. So we'll know what everyone's doing. We'll have access to all the knowledge that's been accumulated throughout history. So effectively, this AI will become omniscient and effectively all powerful. And I've read some of the leading transhumanists are even proposing that this AI could serve as a new god. I believe one of my theories is that possibly what they're trying to do is they're trying to create the beast of Revelation. So I think there's various elements of this end time scenario. So there's the Antichrist, which is also the beast, and I think possibly their intent is to, because I, you know, we've talked about this before, they are doing all this intentionally, right? They're not waiting for these things to happen. The book of Revelation is a blueprint for them. So I believe possibly AI is to be the beast. And somewhere in there, I don't know how it fits again, you know, some kind of externalization of the hierarchy is supposed to happen where aliens will be revealed, exposed in some sort, and some kind of antichrist scenario, and of course, New World Order, which is supposed to be headquartered in Jerusalem, from which, you know, the Zionists expect that they will see the fulfillment of the prophecy that they will be made rulers of the world.
Wow. Well, we shall see. Certainly this idea, Pax Judaica, which has been going around, which I think would better characterize as Pax Satanica, as something which is a global system of control running up to and after a Third World War, the idea really being that people really will have, after a World War like that, will have no choice but to do what they're told. But, you know, with the AI particularly, I mean, the discussions between Conrad and Tucker on this program, they are talking about, I suppose, what you'd have to describe as a kind of post-truth world, information chaos, where artificial intelligence can create fake versions of you who can contact members of your family pretending to be you, create complete fake stories about fake wars, which, by the way, the military psychological warfare people have been doing for many decades, including during the Second World War, of course. You know, the idea of sending out information to wrong foot the enemy. Well, in this case, the enemy happens to be the general public in your own country. But this future of, you know, I mean, I'm as someone who's worked through many years in mainstream journalism, I can see, you know, people like me being completely marginalized, freelance executive journalists, and more and more, more robotic journalists being taken on, staff journalists, to write what they're supposed to write, and they don't stray from what they're told. Now, this can dovetail quite nicely, actually, into AI starting, right, because you would hardly notice the difference at writing news stories. But what do you make of this side? Because the point seems to me to be, if you don't know who's contacting you, you've absolutely no idea what's going on. It's going to cause all sorts of chaos, and the only way you're going to be able to tell, potentially anyway, is if you've checked somebody's digital ID on the other end. And this is one of the things that they talk about here. So it does seem that maybe the way that AI is being sold is absolutely nothing like the reality of what it's their purpose to do. You could say something, I suppose, also similar about this whole occult concept of the elixir of life, which has been out there for centuries, you know, and in fact makes quite a good B-movie as well as, but now they're actually starting to talk about, well, we're genetically engineering humans and we will genetically engineer out the aging genes so that, you know, if you pay us enough, we will engineer things so that when you have a child, it'll live forever. So these are the sorts of worlds we're going into now, which is why I think it's good that people like Tucker have stepped up to the plate and are starting to explore this other dimension to world affairs. But anyway, you talking about the this idea of AI in the Book of Revelation, in a way it's great that they're working to the Book of Revelation, because we can then see what their plan is, you know. And the other thing is that the Revelation talks about this thing called the image of the beast. Now, this is not the beast itself, but it's some kind of statue in Jerusalem, which, you know, various different interpretations, but it looks as if it's a sort of animated person of some kind, animated probably or possibly a robot animated by AI, a kind of almost oracle that actually looks as if it's alive. So
there you go.
Isn't it actually a bit of a problem for them that some of these things in Revelation are, you know, if we from the other side look in, we can figure out exactly what they're up to, maybe.
Yeah, but nobody realizes that. So as far as they're concerned, you know, the majority of the world's completely oblivious.
So. Yeah, well, let's hope that there's a few less like that. But look, yeah. with the Tucker Carlson, Conrad Flynn interview immediately popping up on the internet was this so-called debate, which isn't really a debate. It's much more of a, I think, a people meeting of minds. Between the guy they're talking about there a lot in the interview, Nick Land, this old school based in Shanghai, the author of The Dark Enlightenment, which is a rather sinister, strange look. He talks about channeling it, actually, and which maybe is why it's so barely comprehensible. And also Alexander Dugin from Russia, who is talked about as Putin's brain. Well, I mean, anyway, maybe you could just say something about whether you think he really is Putin's brain and what you made of that discussion they were having.
Yeah, so, I'm not sure what to make about Dugin's apparently influence. Not sure if that's like some kind of disinformation campaign, but I mean, he's definitely the godfather of probably the Fascist International and most of the international far right. So what I discovered recently, this is pretty fascinating. So when you look at Nick Land and Dugin are understood to be representatives of the two poles that have been put forward, right? That so the Nick Land would represent the Atlanticists that that Dugin denounces, while Dugin, of course, is from the Eurasian bloc or the Hyperboreans. So the whole theory, that whole theory of this dichotomy of these two worlds colliding comes from it's a dichotomy devised by Carl Schmitt, who was the jurist of the Nazi regime. So Carl Schmitt is the one who came up with what's called the state of exception, which argued that Hitler was entitled to seize dictatorial powers after the Reichstag fire. So, but despite the fact that the role that he played in Nazi movement, he was good friends with Leo Strauss, who was the godfather of the neoconservative movement, whose followers developed the Clash of Civilizations. So the Carl Schmitt's dichotomy is based on what he believed was the war between the monsters of Leviathan and Behemoth. So a sea monster against a land monster. And he was, the crazy thing is that this is what I wrote about in my Lord of Alcala book, is that Carl Schmitt openly acknowledges his debt to the Kabbalah for this interpretation. And it is derived from Hobbes. So Thomas Hobbes, who was a secretary to Francis Bacon. And so what's interesting is that Peter Thiel also refers to the same myth, so the same idea of a Leviathan, and he did in his recent article about the Antichrist again, which discusses Bacon's New Atlantis. So what's amazing that there's an article that was published, I believe, in Haaretz, right? Very reputable Israeli newspaper, talking about Benjamin Netanyahu's father, because Benjamin Netanyahu was a specialist on the Spanish expulsion, and he wrote a biography of Isaac Abarbanel. And Isaac Abarbanel is particularly interesting because after Rashi, he's one of the most important Jewish personalities of the Middle Ages. He was the one who funded Columbus's voyage to the discover the West. Of course, it's well known now. I think it's effectively been proven that Columbus was Jewish. He also went on the day of the expulsion. It happened to happen on Tisha B'Av, which is a very important day in the Jewish calendar. It's also the day of Shabbatai Zvi's birth. He led the Jewish population to leave Spain. His son, Leon Abreu, was one of the leaders of one of the primary influences in the introduction of Kabbalah into the Renaissance, and particularly in Hermeticism. So this guy is very important. And so what this article proposes is that, I can't remember how it links the Behemoth and Leviathan, but connects, basically shows that Thomas Hobbes was derived his interpretation of the Leviathan from his knowledge of Kabbalah, from the Buxton family. And so effectively, what the article proposes is that, how it ends is that through the influence of his father and his knowledge of Isaac Abarbanel and his understanding of the Kabbalah, that for that, because also, so is among Isaac Abarbanel's, one of his descendants was a female descendant married Manasseh ben Israel. And Manasseh ben Israel was, of course, sort of the leading figure behind, not directly the Rosicrucian movement, but the entire, so Isaac Abarbanel, Manasseh ben Israel was the one who helped to succeed in negotiating with Cromwell to allow the return of the Jews. And he worked in collaboration with the leaders of the Hartlib Circle, also known as Visible College, named after a college mentioned in Bacon's New Atlantis. And so that Invisible College became evolved into the Royal Society, which effectively developed Freemasonry in England, and collaborated closely with the synagogue that was established by Manasseh ben Israel's followers, called the Bevis Marks Synagogue, which was typically led by Sabbatian rabbis. Just to show you how this was all connected.
Okay, let me just interject a minute, because I looked into very closely into Cromwell, a very, very important figure in world history. The first empire was just in its earliest days during the Civil War. Cromwell killed the king, made sure that the empire, the plans for empire were rolled out, went ahead. And he was involved. It's a fascinating pamphlet which was written in France about a century afterwards. And, of course, many of the people who had been attacked by Cromwell congregated around Henrietta Maria, Charles' first wife, in France. And the pamphlet, I think it was called The Freemasons Crushed, because Freemasonry was just emerging. And in that book, there are a whole bunch of people who were testifying as to what was going on behind the scenes with the takeover of the British Parliament, Pride's Purge, where Cromwell's nephew goes into the British Parliament, arrests a whole load of MPs who are about to vote against the impeachment of the king, basically against his arrest, against his trial. And so when it comes to the vote, the MPs who are going to vote, to save the life of the king and to say, well, actually, well, let's just restore the king after the Civil War. They're all in jail. Now, it talks in that book about Cromwell taking a bunch of MPs before all this, actually, because these are the MPs who are going to be spying on the other MPs for him, a hand-picked bunch from all the different parties into St. James in London and to a great hall where he talks about this whole idea of rebuilding the Temple of Jerusalem, and this is a great noble cause they're all going to do. And he shows them a picture of the Jerusalem Temple, massive painting in there, all crushed down. And then in the next room, there it is all properly built. And he said, well, look, he uses this to sort of convince them in a way. Uh-huh. It's the mission we're on. It's a very important mission. It's very secret. And so this is in 1648, before Pride's Purge and before the murder of the king. So this is what makes it, I think, interesting what you're talking about the guy being involved in the return of the Jews to Britain at the time. So I think I'm going to shut up now and let you carry on. But I think it's fascinating to see. And of course, the provenance of pamphlets like this is really it is questionable, but it's a fascinating account, which you know, it wasn't possible to write in Britain at the time. It possibly was in the after the Restoration, but there were still great fears that in Britain, and also, you know, that you're in the run up to the French Revolution in France, I suppose by the 1700s. And it was a much freer country where Catholics, etc., and of course Charles I was pro-Catholic, could discuss and talk about all this. So there was a sort of cell of people in Paris who had all were getting together to say what was Cromwell really up to, what was really going on behind the scenes. So anyway, I hope that helps contribute a little to understanding of you know what these various individuals have been up to over the years.
It does. So there's a whole fascinating network between Cromwell. There's a book, an excellent book that this is one of one of the top historians, I believe, in our time is Marcia Keith Shouchard. She wrote a book called Restoring the Temple of Vision. It's a massive book and just really impressive, the detail of the scholarship that's in there. So she traces the whole evolution, and this is by Brill Publishers, so it's not like it's very very published with very high reputation in academia. So she traces the whole origins of the Kabbalistic notion of temple building back to the Templars and various early Kabbalists who had relationships and influenced the Templars. I talk a lot about this in my book, especially for its relation with like various Templar and Neo-Templar orders, like the Order of Santiago and so on and so forth. And then traces it to this period of Cromwell, which was identified at the time as being a Rosicrucian, effectively a Rosicrucian movement, or that Cromwell's government was dominated by Rosicrucians. And I think what you're talking about is Rabbi Temple. This is a famous example. He who constructed a model of the temple, which became famous, and he toured around Europe to show it. And one famous case is when he presented it to Henrietta. What was her name? Henrietta Maria? Was it the wife of Charles II? I can't remember relationship, but that's why family.
Henrietta Maria was Charles's wife. In fact, the mother of the future Charles as well. He was Charles II, right, who was on the run actually in Britain at the time,
right,
and carrying on the fight.
Right, and so Charles's sister, which is was Elizabeth Stuart, whose marriage to Frederick V of the Palatinate was celebrated in a book called The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, which was written by Johann Andrea, Rosicrucian text. So that's why, it's an entire network of, that's where it's interesting, is these families all can be traced back to the families involved in the First Crusade who were connected to the myth of the swan. And that's why these families, when they conquered Jerusalem, they established themselves as kings of Jerusalem, and their descendants continued to maintain that title even after Jerusalem had been lost to the Muslims. So this idea, this is why I say that I think we can trace Zionism back to the Crusades, because it was a Kabbalistic mission that was carried out by aristocratic families who had all kinds of extensive, genetic relationships to each other and to this whole tradition. So coming back to the point, so here again, from Isaac Abar Manel to his descendant who married Manasseh ben Israel. In Manasseh, there's a letter that was found basically a deal that was struck between Cromwell and Manasseh, that Manasseh would help fund Cromwell's rise to power in return for executing Charles I, who was eventually replaced by Charles II, who inaugurated the founding of the Royal Society, which is effectively a Rosicrucian movement. So again founded, you know, based on the Invisible College, which was mentioned in the Pacifist Bacon, New Atlantis, written by Francis Bacon, mentioned by Peter Thiel, and whose secretary was Thomas Hobbes, who developed this theory of the Leviathan, which is now being repeated by Nick Land, Al Dugin, and Thiel, and now again by Netanyahu's father, who wrote a biography on Isaac Barbanel. So this is actually, I'm just going to read what the article says. So this is an article in Haaretz about, again, Netanyahu's father. It said, Barbanel, Hobbes, and Schmidt, Carl Schmidt, situate potential catastrophe on the horizon somewhere in the future in order to make use of it in the present as a tool for consolidating and intensifying collective consciousness and for defending the political body, the sovereignty of the state. Netanyahu the Younger, meaning Bibi, then understands that only by means of maintaining, sustaining, and managing a potential catastrophe will the collective Jewish political consciousness be preserved as the adhesive that preserves the unity of the Jewish political entity. Then it goes on to describe the why he's using, you know, exploit, that he doesn't want a peace deal, he doesn't want a Palestinian state, he funds Hamas, anything to maintain this sort of this mythology of a, of an ongoing catastrophe, just like a Barbanel would have exploited the idea of the Jewish expulsion as in a catastrophe that was necessary to help sort of, you know, maneuver the Jewish people towards this formation of a state. Then it ends by saying, the article says, thus, in Netanyahu the Younger's playbook, only a perpetual Palestinian threat, only, in quotation marks, management of the conflict and the maintenance of a perpetual state of war can preserve the Jewish state over time.
Well, that's fascinating. But the thing is, it doesn't actually have to be a threat from Palestine at all. It only has to be an illusion of a threat.
Perceived threat, actually.
Yeah, a perceived threat, yeah. A mass media threat.
Right.
A psychological warfare threat. You know, you can put it in all sorts of ways. Spin, ownership of transmitters, ownership of printing presses. That sort of threat is quite adequate. It doesn't have to be really threat.
Ownership of TikTok.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. I mean, back to Nick Land and Dugin, because you talking about Leviathan and Behemoth, it's almost like, I think someone has actually penned an article, if my memory serves me right, comparing the pair of them to these two Hobbesian and biblical creatures.
Exactly. Because that's, again, that comes back to the basis of Dugin's, what he calls sacred geopolitics. So he openly acknowledges his debt to Carl Schmitt for the construction of this Kabbalistic dichotomy, which he transforms into a land and sea dichotomy, which he believes is expressed in a perpetual war between the Atlanticists and the Eurasians. And this is what I argue, is that this is a mirror image of the same clash of civilizations that has been proposed by the neoconservatives. And what's interesting is that Dugin says, I'm going to paraphrase effectively what he said, but he says something along the lines of that we don't fight the Atlanticists because, you know, we hate them. We fight them because it's our civilizational fate. They were born in that part of the world, so it's their duty to represent the fate of that that geographical region. And so he is, because he's part of the Eurasian mainland, that he then necessarily has to represent that block. And so, but this is a necessary, you know, he likes to, I think he uses the word Endkampf, right, which I think was used by Hitler, which is an end times war. This is a necessary conflict which has to happen to bring about the end times, with which Dugin explains is not just something to wait, it's a task that they need to undertake.
Right, so just to recap, the Freemasons Crushed is by Abbé Laridan, and there were no translations into English online I could find of this important section. So, very kindly, Alex Thompson, who from the UK column, who's translated by profession as well as all the other things, he's an ex-GCHQ guy, did, I think, an excellent translation of that, which I will put a link up to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So the book is called The Freemasons Crushed. It was published in the mid-1700s, early mid-1700s, by Abbé Laridan, which just, you know, because I think it's important to try and pin these some of these things down, specifically the importance. I mean, anybody that looks at world history can see that the British Empire was megally important, and also that if you look closely into the Civil War, you can see Charles I putting all sorts of spanners in the works, like the mass evictions that were going on from the countryside in the early 1600s were causing massive poverty, people having to sleep in ditches, etc. And he and Archbishop Laud decided, we're going to stop this. Now, the merchant classes didn't like that because they had a plan, and neither did people like John Dee, I imagine, from previously, who'd set these wheels in motion. But obviously the British Empire was, you know, ended up being a megally important thing that couldn't be allowed some king to sort of stand in the way of. So Cromwell had to take some special measures. But anyway, look, as well as Dugin and Land having this kind of fake debate where they talk about really the minutiae, I think we also, I think it was Dion Fortune, I remember reading a good few years ago, talking about the nature of occultism and the occult essentially being the secret societies behind the scenes moving the chess pieces around. But it's very important to have your kind of spokespeople for them, or the, what they call, what she calls the mystics, who are out there in the public kind of interpreting this. And everyone goes, wow, isn't that great? Someone's actually managed to interpret it. Actually, as it turns out, the they're both part of the same clan, you know, really. Yeah. People who are doing these things want them to be understood in a certain way. So it's the job of Land and Dugin to go out into the public and do that. Anyway, so Nick has put his own, with some podcaster, his response to the Tucker Carlson being talked about on Tucker Carlson, which he, you know, he's getting some credit for being talked about. He's got to obviously come up with an answer or some response. Where he actually hints, and I don't know what you make of this, that he is actually himself a Satanist. What did you make of that section?
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear. I think that's why, you know, it was interesting to listen to, because that clearly seems to be what he's about. And that's definitely the circles where he exercises influence, like especially the accelerationist movement. So, yeah, I thought it was very interesting to listen to his very convoluted attempt to try to hint that he was a Satanist without coming out and confessing it.
What do you make of this idea that maybe these two, but specifically Nick, are there to lead people who are interested up the garden path?
Because you look at throughout history of the sort of dual role of political leaders and mystics. Almost all the mystics have played a crucial role in politics, starting with John Dee, Pappas, Saint-Yves d'Alvet, Blavatsky, Crowley, and now people like Dugin and Land. And I don't really know how that works. I don't know if they're some kind of, but you know, this is the interesting thing about synarchy, is that it's effectively the idea, and then you even go back to Plato, right? Plato had a hierarchy, and at the top of the hierarchy, the top of the hierarchy are priest kings. I don't want to get this too overcomplicated, but this is one of the main points that I show in my book, The Dying God, is that to explain what it is that the priest kings believe, provides the myth of our myth of Air the Armenian, effectively, is what it is, who does a descent to the underworld and describes the visions that he has there, which is basically proof of Plato's dependence on Kabbalah. So even in modern times, the idea of synarchy is the belief that at the very highest rungs of the society, you have priest kings who are in contact with the spirit world, receive their revelations, which they use to then pass off to the political leaders to implement and carry out. So this is why all these revelations are always so important, and this is the true perception from their angle of the Book of Revelation, is that it's information that has been delivered to them from the spirit world to guide their actions. So I do, with Dugin in particular being sort of the modern leader of the Sigonicus tradition, that's, you know, and a follower of Avola who have articulated that kind of idea, I believe maybe that's kind of how they see themselves. They don't need necessarily to pull the strings as much as to be the priests who do the interpreting and hand off the vision and advice to the string pullers.
Well, yeah, but look, David, Nick is very into the idea of demonic possession. He likes the idea of demons possessing him and writing through him and coming out through him somehow. So, I mean, this seems to me to be the way. They want to get all human activity and decision-making out and replace it with these kind of things and also with AI. But, Kurt, just finally, can you very quickly, like in a minute, just give us your website, how people can find and follow you?
Thank you, Tony. So, yes, my website is ordoabcal.ca, and that's where I keep information about myself. I post a few blogs every once in a while. There's at least three books now that are entirely online. You can buy there's links to purchase paper versions of all my books or Kindle versions. I've also recently put out a couple of audio book versions of some of my books, and I've also got a link to my Patreon page. And I used to do Facebook, but Facebook is the enemy. So I do Patreon now, and that's really where I interact the most with my readers, and I share information regularly, post updates, and so on and so forth, and carry on discussions.
David Livingstone in Montreal, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony.